Welcome to Goals Question Time, where I interview leading executives driving innovation, venturing, and strategic change.
So, welcome to Goals Question Time. I've got Ian Harvey with me today, who I'd like to call a good friend, Ian. We've known each other for about, God, how many years? Six, seven,
long
8 years?
Long time, yes.
So, great to have you on now to share some of the insights that I've had the pleasure of having with you and that over the years. Can you give me an introduction to yourself, please? Because you go back quite a bit in terms of intellectual property and things you've been doing over the years.
Well, my career is it's quite simple, really. There were four quite distinct and different career segments. I was an engineer for 10 years. I trained with Vickers, plus a degree in mechanical sciences from Cambridge. I worked in aerospace with Vickers on the design of the Concorde supersonic aircraft. And then I moved into the chemical industry, where I commissioned fixed chemical plant and designed them as well. Then moving into the second segment, I decided that if I was going to become a manager at some point, I should learn a little bit about management. So I took an MBA at Harvard Business School, and from there joined the World Bank in Washington, D.C., and had a very interesting 7 years working on industrial policy in Portugal, agro-industrial projects in Asia, India, Bangladesh, Burma. And then finally, in World Bank, I worked on country policy in French-speaking West Africa, in Guinea. Then my wife and I had been traveling like crazy, hadn't seen enough of our tiny children, and decided that we'd take our retirement out and travel. So we retired for 3 years with our two very small children. Had a wonderful time. After that retirement, I decided that I would like to run something, and I became the chief executive of the British Technology Group, BTG, and I was there for 19 years. It was then
a government... quite a bit of coming out of retirement. Quite a bit of coming out of retirement. That was a little sabbatical, I'd say, for 3 years.
A sabbatical, fine.
BTG.
Yes. But BTG then was a government-owned company, patenting and licensing the majority of the technologies coming out of the UK universities and government research labs. Some of those products were major global products. It was by far the world's largest tech transfer company. Our revenues were roughly double the total revenues from the entire US university sector. And in fact, it was only in 1980 with the Bayh-Dole Act, which was actually modeled on what the UK had been doing for 30 years, that allowed US universities to really commercialize what they had developed with US government funding. And it was at BTG, as you know, that I really had to learn about IP, because we were licensing patents. But of course, in addition to patents, there's a broad range of IP as well. And what I found was that the majority of CEOs of the companies that we licensed really didn't understand the basics of the IP on which their companies were then largely based. So after I did properly retire from BTG, it led to my fourth and final career segment, which was a bit of a crusade to try and get business schools to teach the basics of IP. And largely I failed. Harvard Business School weren't interested. Imperial College took it up for a little while. And in fact, the only one which took a serious interest was Tsinghua University Business School in Beijing. And I structured and organized a course on innovation, IP, and corporate strategy, which I ran there for about 10 years.
So I think that when you got into your retirement and doing your stuff in Imperial and Tsinghua, that's where we both got to know each other.
Yes.
And I think we both got this passion about the value of intellectual property, intellectual assets, and how it needs to be seen in the context for a startup, for a corporate, and for sort of investors. So could you give us the elevator pitch then for why intellectual assets, intellectual property is so important for businesses these days?
Well, one of the sad things I've discovered, Andrew, is that there's really no elevator pitch, because you can give the very simple things about IP, that it gives you the right to use your invention for 20 years in return for making it public so that everyone can use it. Most people, just given that, don't understand the implications and the breadth of what it does. So give me half an hour and I can give enough examples. But as far as you're concerned here, it provides the incentive for companies to invest in what has been invented. Invention is usually 5 or 10% of the total. Then you need to invest to make it work, to see if it works, to make it feasible in terms of production, to make it fit what the market actually wants. And that is 90 to 95% of the time and of the investment needed. And it is that incentive to invest that is the, I see, as the fundamental part of IP, particularly patents.
And so with the startups, you were spinning out then a BTG and then you sort of supported. What are some of the key messages that you want those entrepreneurs and investors to know how they manage their IP at the start?
Well, I'll come back to that point, but what you said there really wasn't quite accurate, because what we licensed, only 10% went to startups, 90% went to existing companies.
All right, okay.
They had the understanding, the wherewithal to take on a technology and develop it rapidly. The failure rate of startups is very high. So as a university, if you want to be successful at commercializing what you've invented, then actually licensing an existing company is often the preferred choice.
Okay.
If you take MIT, for example, which I hold up as the gold standard for universities commercializing their inventions, 90% of their technologies go into existing companies, only 10% go into startups. But if you're talking about small firms, particularly in the high-tech area, you have to make some choices, because it isn't always obvious that you should patent what you've done. Patenting is expensive. It takes time. You have to enforce it. So if the technology, if what you've developed is pretty fundamental and important, then of course you should patent it. And that'll give your investors the incentive to keep funding you until the product is pretty visible. And then of course you have the choice of, are you going to make it yourself? Are you going to license it? Are you going to sell it to someone else? Are you going to put it into the public domain as open source? Because that is also a quite valid commercial route. But there's an interesting book by Kai-Fu Lee, which is AI Superpowers, China, Silicon Valley, and New World Order.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. Yeah.
Highly recommended. And what he points out is that in high tech, particularly in China, it's very rapidly moving. And actually, you're much better off just to keep going without spending the time, the effort, the money in terms of creating patents.
Yeah.
Because the technology moves so quickly. On the other hand, against that, if you look at your typical smartphone, 250,000 patents in that smartphone, which have merged and come together with all the owners, the majority of the owners of those patents, making tiny amounts out of very large numbers of sales. So I wouldn't make the argument that you need to patent everything in sight, but it brings me to the point that IP has to be part of your corporate strategy. You have to understand what you have, how patentable it is, how it compares with what your competitors are doing, what they have, what they've already patented. And then you have to make choices about where does your particular invention fit in this larger picture.
Yeah.
If you're a pharmaceutical company, it's very clear that there probably won't be many people in that particular area. So a patent is absolutely vital for the hundreds of millions of dollars which you need to spend to develop that technology. If it's a medical device, it'll be rather less, rather shorter time, but still patents are absolutely central. Once you move into the high tech area, then you really need to be much more careful and thoughtful about what your patent is going to do, why you have it, and how you're going to use it.
Yeah. And, you know, building on your point and that there about the different approaches along it, you were a great help to me in the book that I wrote about purpose to performance and what I subtitled the innovative new value chain. Because as you sort of said there, there's the patterns at one end around the sort of technology. But what I'm seeing now around startups is they've got to manage an ecosystem. So, for example, one of the ventures I'm now a director on, we spun out patents from BP. So we've got intellectual property on the cartridge sort of type technology and use in particular sectors. Yeah. But now to get a circular economy solution going, you need an IT platform. You need brands, you need relationships, you need contracts and MOUs and that with the various partners across that ecosystem. And I think the ecosystems we're now seeing in, you know, the likes of Alibaba in online sort of areas or in the brands like Apple brands, you know, the intellectual property, the Apple brand is made up of that being able to bring together the ecosystem, as you said, of thousands of patents and manufacturers and the know-how that they have in those areas. So it is a complex thing to think about, isn't it?
Yeah. And just going on to how well or not companies manage their IP, in far too many companies, even today, certainly medium to larger size firms, IP is seen as a somewhat arcane issue. It belongs in the legal department. It's not particularly visible. And so it's almost like a mechanistic process that you have to file a patent and that's done. Whereas in fact, it should be, as I said earlier, much more integrated into the overall strategy of the company. Why do we have it? What's it going to be used for? What are our competitors doing? Also, if you study the IP environment, you can see what your competitors are doing. And understanding that will give you a lead into what your commercial strategy should be. Are you going to collaborate with them? Are you going to sue them to take them out of the business if you think that they're going to infringe your patents? There are very many issues. One example I think I may have shared with you before is that Air Liquide, the gases company in France, had a regular monthly meeting between its head of marketing, its head of IP, and its head of technical development. And they would continuously review not just what they had done, but what the marketplace was doing. And in one of their particular areas, they had run into a chemical roadblock that they couldn't see where the next step forward was. And they'd stopped development in that particular area. In one of these monthly meetings, the head of IP pointed out that one of their major competitors had actually found a new route around this roadblock. Right. And once that was done, it opened up a whole new area of chemistry. And then they continued their development using this insight. And that eventually became a major product for Air Liquide without infringing the patents of their competitor.
Yeah.
So this insight of what the marketplace is doing, that is the whole purpose of patents. It is to tell the world what you've done so they can build upon that. And in return, you get your 20-year right to use it. But this idea of building on what is publicly exposed is actually a valuable part of what IP does.
Mm, yeah. And I think it's so important, looking at it from the investor perspective as well, because I'm involved in a number of angel networks. Yeah. And I think, you know, I and other angels now want to make sure that, yeah, we don't just want to know, oh, yes, I filed for a patent. Well, okay, big deal. You haven't actually got it yet. But where does it fit within the overall sort of strategy and your approach? I think it's so important to help startups with that when you're an angel investor and support and challenge it.
Yes. You also need to think, maybe not in your case, because you're mainly European-based, but if any of this reaches people in the US, the US patent system, in my view, is really not fit for purpose now.
Right.
Okay. It is very difficult and expensive for small and medium companies, startups, to really create and enforce their patents. The larger companies can dominate them by because you can challenge the patent before it's granted now in the US. It makes it very difficult for small and medium companies, unless they're extremely well funded by people in Silicon Valley. It is very difficult for them to find their way through the patent process. In Europe, it's much easier.
Yeah, no, I recognize that. I think one of the certainly from a number of startups I've been involved in or business I've sort of invested in, when you go and do the you start discussing with your patent advisor, and they sort of give you the list of the trade classes and the countries, and it's like, oh, and we've got to get an agent in that country, and then there's multiple iterations. It does feel very much a broken process in these days of online applications and online processes and things like that. So, changing subjects slightly, Ian, we've both got experience in that within China, and you've just raised sort of Kai-Fu Lee. I think it was an excellent example of, as he outlines in the book, of the shift in artificial intelligence or this sort of technology area where it might have been created in another country, but that the arc of the development now, whether it's on solar panels, electric cars, artificial intelligence and stuff like that, the rise of China that we've seen. What's your sort of perspective on that from, your great experience in IP, but also now being being the chair of the IP Center in Tsinghua and sort of stuff like that over a number of years. What's your view on this sort of rise of China and how we can work together?
Well, the starting point is that China is going to be a major technological source. It is beginning to dominate a number of areas, the most obvious ones being batteries. If you look at fintech, and AI, it's dominating in probably three out of the four or five areas. But first and foremost, if you have important patents, you really should file in China. Intellectual property in China is a big, crucial, and complex topic, but there are really some very important facts that should drive commercial decisions. And one of the common themes that you hear about IP in China is the theft of IP by China. And I think I divide that issue in two parts. The first is state-run espionage. Most major states do this. China's is probably pretty good at it, but that's for others to address. The second area is commercial IP, and this can be stolen in any country. As Google found out in the US with Uber, and as Ocado did with one of its founders in the UK, any company which has proprietary IP, patents, know-how, and so on, trade secrets, needs to be careful. Certainly in China, you do have to be particularly careful to protect your IP, particularly related to know-how and trade secrets. But if you have a patent in China, for example, the data show that as a foreign company, you're more than twice as likely to be able to enforce your patent than you are as a foreign company in the United States. 80% of foreign companies in China enforce their patents through the court system. Only about 33% of foreign companies in the US manage to enforce their patents through the court system.
Just to clarify there, then you're saying the Chinese IP patents registration, if you register your patent in China, like we've just been recommending in any state, when you do put it there, it's easier and more enforceable than the United States.
Absolutely. In China, it'll take you one at the most 2 years to go through the total court system, and it'll probably cost you $100,000 to $200,000. In the United States, the same process would probably take you 5 to 7 years and probably cost you anywhere between $4 and $5 million and $10 million. The two systems are completely different in terms of the ease of use of them.
And let me challenge partly is that because is do they treat foreign companies any differently, or are they blind to where the companies sort of come from? So are they, oh yes, we'll attack foreigners, or but if you're a Chinese company, we'll be more lenient on you. Do you see that, or is that just a myth in that as well, in terms of that those patents sort of courts and that?
I think once you get to the higher court levels, particularly the IP tribunal of the Supreme Court, from everything I hear, it is pretty geographic neutral, and that what you get is a good decision based on the IP facts and overall structure. There was a time, probably 10, 15 years ago, when it was actually rather harder for a foreign company to get a granted patent in China than it was for a domestic firm. And that, from what I heard at the time, that was because they didn't want a foreign company to have a granted patent, which was then overturned properly in their court because it hadn't been properly examined. That has now changed, and the patent office in China is very good by global standards, probably significantly better than the US. What it's very good at doing is using AI to identify what is called prior art. Has this been done before? Not just in China, right, but in every other country. And it is fine. It is turning up prior art, which will prevent a patent from being granted more frequently than, say, the US Patent Office does.
Okay. Okay. Good. Yeah.
And just going back to geographic preference, if you start in the very lowest court, there may be some geographic preference, but then you shouldn't start in the lowest court. You should start in the intermediate court, which is pretty neutral. And then once you get to the next court, which is the appeal process, you will find that it is basically judged on the merits of the case.
Yeah.
So that really comes down to, if you're going to operate in China, you have to operate, you have to use people who really understand the Chinese system.
Yeah.
Because the Chinese system, as I said earlier, actually operates very quickly. And in some cases, particularly in the earlier courts, you will have to respond to the court within 1 or 2 weeks. And if you have to send all this back to head office in Europe and the United States, you just run out of time. So you have to have local delegation and local expertise. And if you have that, then you can operate quite effectively in China in terms of both getting your patents and then using them to defend against those who might infringe them.
Yeah, no, excellent. And you've written a very good report, I know, and you keep updating it, which I've circulated to a number of people, because I referred to it in my book, where I particularly got a chapter as well on this, that, you know, China now with its industrial capability and its joining together and using the next generation of technology, as you said, in batteries and smart systems and environmental sort of things is really sort of moving up now, and that flywheel is turning. So while they might have learnt from the West, they are now taking it to the next stages. And I think you make a comment in your book, in your article about, well, the Americans did it to the British with the spinning jenny at a previous industrial revolution. So, hey, that's the way things are and sort of move.
Just in terms of how seriously the Chinese take IP, IP patents were one of the first goods, things that Chinese people could actually physically own. And that was created in 1984 after the Cultural Revolution. And its IP and the development of it has been part of their 5-year plans ever since then. Wen Jiabao, who was the premier in about 2004, said, competition in the future is competition in IP. And as part of their 5-year plans, all school children are taught about patents, copyright, trademarks. And primary school children are taught about patents. I've got the comic books for the 7-year-olds about patents and copyright. So by the time they're 10 or 11 years old, they know more than most people in the West.
Yeah. No, it's amazing. I've seen those when I visited you. You've shown me those, and it is.
And also, just to add about why to file a patent in China. China is a gigantic economy. If you filed a patent in the United States or Europe, it's in the public domain. People can see what you have patented and what you have done. If you don't file a patent in China, the Chinese are perfectly free, legally under international law, to use exactly what you've patented elsewhere. And they're free to use it in any other country where there is no patent. So if you want to ignore a country of 1.2 billion people and let them use your technology freely, then don't file a patent in China. But if you want to have the protection there, so you can either manufacture or license a Chinese firm, then you must file in China.
Yes. Yeah. And I think you raise an important point, sort of tangential point for me there is, We from the West often look at that sort of, oh, we'll do Europe, we'll do the US. China is, of course, looks at China first. It then looks at Asia. It then looks at Africa. It then looks at South America. So it's like, well, okay, if you develop something and they use that pattern to develop something or accelerate the progression and that of it, then fine. You know, that's the legitimate, that's the rules of the game, isn't it? And they could develop into those other countries and the growing markets.
That's absolutely right. If you're filing patents in Europe, for example, you probably won't file in every country because you want to file different patents in different countries, so you don't have to bear the total cost of filing every patent in every country. And as you just said, you need to target where you're going to be filing patents so you can get the coverage and protection that you want at a sensible cost. China is such a large node that if you want to have that protection, China covers many other countries which wouldn't otherwise have patents.
Yes, yeah. No, great points on that there. But I'd like to take us on to one more topic, which is more from the technology point. And we've touched on it a few times already, artificial intelligence. You know, Kai-Fu Lee's book, you recommend it, AI Superpower. Have you actually read AI 2041, his other book?
His second book, I thought that was very good, where he takes a number of technologies where they currently are and then asks authors to develop imaginary stories about how these technologies might be used. And then he critiques them and says, this is feasible, that is not feasible. But the ideas of what you can do with the current state of AI and other high tech areas is really quite astonishing.
Yeah, it is. No, I'd really recommend it. I'll put that in the link to this podcast because as you said, the format of the book of having, you know, about a topic like education or autonomous vehicles and having a science fiction writer writing the first half of it about what it's going to be like in now 18 years time, not 20 years time as when he wrote it in 2021. And then him doing the part about, well, what's going to be feasible, because his fund, and you know, because he's investing in these businesses, and I've met a number of his team members in Shenzhen who are investing in those startups, and I've read some of his stuff, and he said, well, I'm not investing in the rest of the world now, I'm doing it here where this software and this hardware and these things are coming together and being built. So it is an interesting, thought-provoking book, actually, in what is likely to be feasible, you know, and he's very good in sort of saying, well, yeah, it's likely to get this far, but we're still going to have workarounds and sort of stuff like that.
Yeah.
So any more broader thoughts? You talked about artificial intelligence now being used for looking at prior art, and that. What other applications are you starting to sort of see at the moment, or are you thinking coming in that area or other area of technology thing?
I think it could be applied in so many areas, and you see so many stories, some scare stories, some which are likely to come to reality. I find it very difficult to identify particular areas as being the most likely ones. But I'd just like to go back to China for a second in that broad area, because, as you know, I was quite heavily involved in China from 2004. I was a strong proponent of collaboration with China because I've seen in my time with BTG that you create innovation through people bouncing their ideas off each other. China has a long history of innovation, you know, going back to gunpowder and, you know, 2000 years. They're an argumentative people, which is also a good sign. And for a very long time, I saw the conjunction of China with the creativity of certainly parts of the rest of the world, the US and Europe, as being a very creative one. And one of the arguments I used was, we have environmental issues. I see that China is likely to be a significant source of the technological solutions to the problems which we now have.
Yes.
Over the past 18 months, I think I've become rather more wary, certainly with Xi Jinping. I strongly endorsed what he did in his early period, but now what he's done in making himself premier for life and so on, I think that's dangerous. And there's another book which I would recommend, which I haven't read, but my wife has summarized it for me, which is The Long Game, China's Grand Strategy to Displace American Order, Bridging the Gap by Rush Doshi. And that, I hear, is really quite a warning about the long-term strategy of China to dominate particular areas. That this is commercial as much as military, but I do plan to read it, but I think it just fits with my increasing level of caution of working with China in terms of collaboration. If you're a company and there's a market in China, you really should be there because it is a huge market. But in terms of long-term strategies for governments, maybe as much as, or rather than companies, we really need to be quite or more cautious and careful than I would have argued for 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah. But partly pushing back a little bit, Ian, is like you, because I think you raised a good point earlier about the 5-year plans. It's like China has been reasonably open about this stuff. You go back and read their 5-year plan from 5 years ago and 10 years ago and 15 years ago. It's like, well, you know, you're going to build your industrial capability. You're going to build your intellectual know-how. You're going to bring people out of poverty and sort of stuff like that. Is it those 5-year strategic strategies for the country and then for the big companies and for the tech and for the universities and stuff like that has almost been there for us to sort of see, hasn't it?
You're absolutely right, as it refers to the internal use and the way China is developing internally. What I was just referring to is the way China plans to operate externally and how it would like to dominate areas and what it is doing. And the book I just mentioned is very well researched in terms of what has been published, but it brings it all together in a way which you can begin to understand what Chinese plans for its external relations are.
Yeah. No, excellent. I'll be adding that to my list. Ian, I think that's been fantastic. Really enjoy catching up with you. I've learned some more, even though I've known you for many years and all that. There, I've learned some more.
Nice of you to say so.
And we do have these conversations often when we meet up, and that anyway. But I'm so pleased we're able to sort of share it with many of our listeners now, who are coming from corporates and coming from startups and investors and all that as well. So thanks very much for sharing your time and insights.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Very good to talk again.
Do subscribe to future videos and podcasts and give us a 5-star rating. Thank you.